Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new turbocharged Acura RDX with available real-time traffic alerts. More at acura.com/RDX.
This podcast is a production of KCRW.com.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner, and this is The Business.
So you still want to do the show business, and you think that you got what it takes? I mean, you really got to rap and be all that. Prepare yourself for the breaks. Check it out.
Actor Bruce Dern calls his unrepentant memoir, Things I've Said But Probably Shouldn't Have. This week on The Business, Dern says more things he probably shouldn't have, and this time, it's on tape. And the networks roll out the dog and pony show for the TV critics. But first, it's the Hollywood News Caravan. Stay tuned, it's The Business from NPR. We begin the caravan with news that the world is about to end. Again. And again. Three, count them, three films are coming out in the next year in which various threats to our existence are indubitably defeated by some sort of CGI-fueled heroics. Next June, the world will be destroyed by parasites of some type in the Fox thriller The Happening, directed by M. Night Shyamalan. But J.J. Abrams, producer of Lost, may have already beaten M. Night to the apocalyptic punch because his pal Matt Reeves' new movie, codenamed Cloverfield, is slated for a January release. Cloverfield's main threat, of course, is a monster, coincidentally codenamed The Parasite. But then again, by the time these thrillers hit theaters, audiences could be world-weary of all this world-ending. And that's because producer Joel Silver's not waiting until next year to end the world. His new movie, Invasion, comes out next month. And naturally, it's about an epidemic of alien parasites. The world might survive, but the business might not. Screenwriters are tired of being treated like parasites, and they're threatening to strike. Last week, negotiations began in earnest between the Writers Guild of America and the Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers. The writers want to make sure they're going to get their fair share from digitally distributed content. The studios look online and say, what money? The only thing we see on the web is our movies, illegally pirated. Strike or no, entertainment industry employment will decline nearly 2% next year, to 161,000 jobs, after a brief 1% increase. And that's according to a new report from the LA County Economic Development Corporation. The report attributes job growth in the short term and decline in the long term to stockpiling of film and TV materials, in anticipation of a possible strike by the writers. Now, I hate to say this, screenwriters, but I think the cunning move you're executing is called being hoist by your own petard. And finally, our heartfelt congratulations to the many talented people nominated for Emmy Awards last week. The many, many people in the 90, count them, 90 categories. And that's just for nighttime TV. We are especially psyched about the Outstanding Hairstyling for a Series nominees, Dancing with the Stars, Desperate Housewives, Rome, and Deadwood? Wild Bill Hickok, I think your hair looks fabulous. And that's the Hollywood News Caravan. Coming up next, things actor Bruce Dern has said, but probably shouldn't have. It's just about impossible to get show business people to talk candidly about the egomaniacal, morally questionable, drug and alcohol addicted and or incompetent people they work with. That is, until later in their careers, when it's time to write the tell-all, filled with salacious stories. And now, actor Bruce Dern has done just that. He's written what he refers to as an unrepentant memoir entitled Things I've Said But Probably Shouldn't Have. Aside from the juicy stuff, the book also provides a look at the business of show business, and specifically the place where talent, moxie, luck, and relationships collide to make or break a career. For nearly 50 years, Dern has been a workhorse actor, appearing in a very long list of TV shows and movies, from Coming Home to Silent Running to They Shoot Horses, Don't They? He's worked with Nicholson, Redford, and Heston, worked for Hitchcock and Ashby. He's been nominated for an Oscar and an Emmy. And yet, Dern is an actor who doesn't need no introduction. That's partially because of an irascible character and maybe some questionable career moves, including his star turn in The Incredible Two-Headed Transplant, which has been called the second best two-headed transplant movie of 1971.
Okay, now, you go on home.
Yes, Mr. Roger.
Gee, I'm very sorry about that.
Oh, that's okay.
Ken, I'm sorry.
You know, he only has the mentality of about an 8-year-old.
Oh, really?
He was trapped in a mine cave-in when he was young, not very far from here. When they finally reached him, he'd suffered irreparable brain damage.
But Dern has no regrets and great stories to tell. Bruce Dern, welcome to the business.
Thank you, sir. Glad to be here.
You started in legitimate theater, as Variety likes to call it, legit, as opposed to burlesque, working with Ilya Kazan and Lee Strasberg. How did you end up in Hollywood?
Well, you know, it all depends how you dream. My goals were simple. Go to New York, work for Kazan, become a member of the Actors Studio. Those were my three goals. When I got to New York, those things happened fairly quickly for me. And by 1961, after having been in that for 3.5 years, Mr. Strasberg finally, after having done two plays for Mr. Kazan, a movie for Mr. Kazan, everybody else who I had come into the Actors Studio with and come to New York at the same time as Jane Fonda, Ron Liebman, and all these other guys, and they were going to New York, Hollywood immediately. Not Brucey. Brucey, no, you stay here. You got to learn. You have an unusual instrument, so you've got to learn. You know, we have kind of a guinea pig on our hands, so you're going to stay and stay. And they held me back, and finally he said...
This is Strasberg, yeah.
He said to me, and I was kind of under contract to Mr. Kazan. And he said, you just listen to Lee. Lee will tell you when it's ready to go. Finally, Memorial Day weekend, 1961, he said, you can go. You can go to California. I'll make a living. Because, I mean, I was starring in an off-Broadway play, Orpheus Descending, I was getting $45 a week. That's what you got to star. So then I came to California, and I started climbing yet another ladder. I'd climbed the Broadway ladder from 6 lines to about 25 lines. And I climbed the off-Broadway ladder with a starring role right away. And then I came to Hollywood, and I started being the 6th cowboy from the right in a wagon train and started climbing there, and I'm still climbing, you know.
How did you sort of get acclimated and learn the precepts, not just of acting, but of the business side of acting?
You know, a lot of actors and writers and set designers, or I don't know who all you have on your shows, but they will tell you that it's an art form. Well, there is a part of it that is an art form, but... The real art is the business art. And in order to get to be the artist, to have an opportunity to be the artist you want, you better learn the art of what the business is of the section that you're in. And the key to the art of the business is the ability to dance. You got to be able to dance around every single kind of situation you're ever in. And we learned very early on that you got to make yourself be in the right place at the right time by getting in the room. And we learned at least I did on my very first day of interviews. The key thing is learning how to read upside down. I mean, you go in and there's a secretary, right, and you got your little pathetic picture with a bunch of lies on the back saying you were in this and you were in that, things they could never check on. So you look at the thing and you see that your appointment was at 3:10. Somebody else is at 3:14. That means you have 4 minutes.
To impress.
Yeah. So my very first interview was with Lynn Stallmaster when I came to Hollywood. And I walked in his office, and he was on the phone. And I made an instant decision that forever cost me dearly the early years in my career. And that was, I ripped the phone out of his hand, and I slammed it down in the cradle, and I said, look, you son of a bitch, I got 3 minutes and 20 seconds left, and you're talking on the telephone with somebody else. And he says, hey, let me tell you something right now. You will never make it in this town. You will never make it in this business. That's exceedingly rude. There's absolutely nothing that you could do for me. I would never cast you in anything. You have no manners, and you don't belong here. So within a week after that, Bradford and Jack and Harry Dean and myself and Michael Parks was another one I don't mention, but he's a fabulous actor. But anyway, so we made a decision to conscientiously work the lots. So when anybody could get on a lot, his duty was to get the other leave passes for the other guys so they could get on the lot the day he worked on a bonanza. And it was normally universal because when I first came to Hollywood in 1961, this will floor you, but Universal Studios alone did 14 hours a week of Westerns on television.
So what does it mean to work the lot? I mean, when that much television isn't being shot...
Well, what it meant was there are 14 hours a week. That means there are 14 offices making a Western, an hour Western, that's being shown on one of the three networks every single week. You know, no matter what the network was, CBS, NBC, ABC. So there are 14 offices, which means there's 14 secretaries that are getting a new script every single week. And in those years, you did 39 episodes a year, not 22. So all but 13 weeks, they were working. So you'd go in and you had to work the secretaries. You had to get to know who the girls were. And Universal had girls with great names. They had one girl that did, you know, Wagon Train named Shirley Morningstar. So we would work. We'd go in. And all we wanted from the secretary was for her not to trash our picture and resume and slip us the next episode of Laredo or whatever the show is, The Virginian. And we would go outside and we would quickly read it. And we'd see there was a guy in Neville Grand. Neville Brand was going to be the guest star in one. And he had three thugs that were in a gang with him. And each thug had about eight lines. And then we'd run out and say, I'd call my agent, you know, Mike Gruskoff. And I'd say, Mike, there's a part of Larry. He's a thug in the next episode of The Virginian. And it's the number nine part in the show. He's got about eight lines. But you could call Jerry Henshaw now and says, what about Bruce Dern? He says, have you got anything for Bruce Dern coming up in the next episode? And Jerry Henshaw, if he'd say, nah, there's nothing for him. I've seen the script. Mike Gruskoff had enough balls because he was like we were, only he was an agent. He was our age. He'd say, you're lying, Jerry. There is a part in there. How the f*** do you know that? He said, well, because somebody told me. The director told me. And he'd never question. He's scared to question the director. He didn't know it was one of us. So he'd say, oh, yeah, there's something. He could come in and read for it or something. And we knew if we could get a reading, we'd pretty much get the part or get a chance because we knew we were good.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Bruce Dern, the Oscar and Emmy-nominated actor of the stage and large and small screen. His new memoir is Things I've Said But Probably Shouldn't Have. You sort of famously were the guy for a while who killed John Wayne in The Cowboys. And you also coaxed Bill McKinney into doing Deliverance. And that role may have killed...
Well, I didn't coax him into doing it. I encouraged him to do it the way he did it. Yeah.
Right. Well, he sort of came on set foaming at the mouth and people thought he was completely checked out.
Oh, yeah.
And that role may have killed his career.
I want to ask you... Yeah. I mean, it was fabulous. He was so good. He was too good.
Can these things be... career killers? I mean, what are the...
Well, he went on, and he had other opportunities, but he stopped taking those kinds of roles, and the business passed him by.
Stopped taking the bad guy, the crazy guy.
The sickos.
The sickos.
And the business passed him by.
But I guess what I want to know from you is, when you take a part that is fraught, where you're going to be acting particularly crazy or particularly fearsome... where you're going to do something that's particularly heinous, killing John Wayne, for instance, are you aware of the implications of what that's going to do to your career or what that can do to your career?
I wasn't until I took that role.
Mm.
And then...
What happened?
I wasn't until I saw how seriously he took it while I was doing the role. We get to the day where it actually, the day before I actually shoot him, he beat the living hell out of me. I mean, physically in the fight scene. And I go on in the book quite a bit about it, you know.
Do you think he was goading you?
Huh?
You think he was goading you?
Oh, absolutely. And then the next morning, he was having bullet hits put on him for the scene where he got shot.
Explain that so that people...
Well, a little explosives they put on you under your shirt that are going to blow holes in your shirt and packets of blood are going to come out so it looks like you've been shot. Well, he'd never had these put on him.
John Wayne doesn't get killed
in movies.
No,
he never got
killed.
So we come to that morning, and he's about 50% tanked, and he leans into me. And
this is John.
John Wayne. And he says, oh, they're going to hate you for this. And I said, maybe. But in Berkeley, I'm a goddamn hero. And he laughed, and he put his arm on my shoulder. He said, that's the exact reason that the son of a bitch is playing the role in this film, because he understands that villains were funny. Then he proceeded to tell me, he said, you'll never live it down. He said, people will hound you the rest of your life.
Let's talk a little bit about losing three jobs in one day.
Ooh.
How did you lose three jobs in one day?
Well, there was a terrific script called Tulane Blacktop that was around for a long time that finally was going to be made as a movie. And they wanted me to play this part in it. And they offered my agent the part at about 5 minutes of 12 on a Tuesday morning. And they offered me $1,000 a week for 10 weeks. He says, well, I'll go to lunch and I'll come back and think about Michael Laughlin was the producer. And Michael Laughlin said, this is the offer. It's not going to change. Ronnie Leaf was my agent. Ronnie Leaf says, well, I'll go to lunch and I'll call you after lunch. And he says, this is the offer. It's not going to change. So he went to lunch, came back, called him up, and Warren Oates had the part. That was one. About 2:30 in the afternoon, there was a movie I'd read for with Alan Arkin called Deadhead Miles. And we rode down in an elevator, Alan Arkin and I, and he said, you were terrific in the reading. And he said, there's no way at all that you won't play the part and everything. Well, about 2:30 that afternoon, they called my agent, Ronnie Leaf, the same guy, and they said, it's just not going to happen on Deadhead Miles for Bruce. We're using Paul Benedict.
So that's two.
So that's two. And about 5:30 that afternoon, Marty Baum called Ronnie Leaf, and he said, I want you in my office at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. We're going to make the Bruce Dern deal on the Grissom Gang. 9 o'clock tomorrow morning, which was still in the same 24-hour cycle. We went to Marty Baum's office.
Who was?
Who was the head of Seven Arts Productions, who were making a movie directed by Bob Aldrich called The Grissom Gang. And Bob Aldrich was in Hawaii somewhere or someplace. And Marty Baum called him up when I was in the office, and they had a speaker, you know, so you could hear him. And he said, hi, Bob, it's Marty Baum. I'm here with Bruce Dern. I'm ready to make his deal for the Grissom Gang. And Bob Aldrich, I could hear his voice on the speakerphone, said, I don't want Bruce Dern. I want Scott Wilson. I told you that. I don't want Bruce Dern. I had him in Hush, Hush, Sweet Charlotte. He said, he's all right, but he's not right for this gang. He's not crazy enough. I want the guy who was in Cold Blood. He's not as dangerous as the guy who was in Cold Blood. And Marty Baum did like this. He put his hand over the telephone speaker, turned to Paul Lazarus, who was his assistant, who later went on to become a studio head, and he said, get Scott Wilson's agent on the telephone. And I had big tears in my eyes, and I just sat there. I realized I was done. And so they hung up, and he turned to me, and Marty Baum put his arms out, and he said, that's showbiz.
I'm talking with actor Bruce Dern about his nearly 50 years in show business. His new memoir is Things I've Said But Probably Shouldn't Have. You're listening to The Business from NPR.
Yeah.
You're listening to The Business, and I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. Bruce Dern has been a working actor for almost 50 years. He starred in some really great movies, from Coming Home to Silent Running, and been nominated for an Oscar and an Emmy. But mostly, he's been cast as the psycho and the bad guy, and he's never broken out as a bankable star. Part of that has to do with some rather bad decisions. Bruce Dern's new memoir is Things I've Said, but probably shouldn't have. You passed on the Martin Sheen role in Gandhi.
Yeah.
You had the chance to work with Francis Ford Coppola, The Godfather. Well, you passed on Bernardo Bertolucci.
I passed on testing for The Godfather.
You passed on a Woody Allen movie. Why?
With Coppola, he wanted me to go up and test with a bunch of other actors, Al Pacino and Bobby Duvall, and he said Marlon and so
test
forth.
Test for The Godfather.
Yeah, for The Godfather, Godfather 1.
Yeah.
And I said, what do you mean, Bobby Duvall? Why are you having him test? He's done two movies for you. He's been absolutely fantastic in both. Why would you not just use him? Why are you making him test? He said, well, because I'm thinking of you for that role, too. I said, hey, Francis, that's not right. I mean, what about loyalty? Bobby Duvall is fabulous every time out. So, I mean, hire him. And he was upset. He didn't understand. And I said, I'm not in it. You're not going to get Brando to go up there. He's not going to do an acting test with those people. Oh, yeah. Anyway, he didn't. And Duvall, he did use Duvall, and he should have. And but he never offered me the role.
But Coppola was furious with you for challenging him on this. And he said, you know, with that attitude, you're not going to have much of a career. And I guess I want to ask you, was Coppola right? You know, you're friends and contemporaries with Jack Nicholson. You certainly have the ability.
I don't look back. I never look back. People, you know, when you're on a book tour like I am now, people say, you know, well, what are the roles that you wished you'd have gotten? What are the, what you didn't really get some of the great starring roles or anything like that. Hey, I starred in a lot of movies. I was never really comfortable as a movie star. A lot of the movies that I starred in were movies that were turned down by a lot of people. I was the 17th choice for Silent Running. They started with Paul Newman and went 16 other guys after him.
You say in your book that about 75% of everything you've learned about the business, you've learned from B-movies. And obviously you're talking mostly about acting here, but and technique, but what did you learn about the business from B-movies?
Well, I was lucky enough, we were lucky enough, about 50 of us were lucky enough to go to the University of Roger Corman. And that's where I really learned the bulk of my education, because he was open to us to let us, like Mr. Hitchcock was open to his crews, to let us pick his brain every single day, because they were shy and withdrawn. But if you would go to them and ask them questions, they would give you exact answers. And so you got an education that allowed you to apply those to A movies.
What were the lessons that they gave you?
The biggest thing I learned from Roger Corman was, and Mr. Hitchcock, the same thing, was that if you tell me on day one that you can do something, then do it. They were never afraid to delegate authority. They were like Lombardi that way. In other words, Lombardi had the best assistant coaches. You look at the directors that worked under Roger Corman, that worked there as cameramen or prop men, or whether it's Joe Dante or Mike Fennell or Jonathan Demme or Francis or Peter Bogdanovich or all these guys that worked for Roger at various stages like that. Well, they learned the same thing, and that was to delegate authority. And they were delegated authority, and they went off, and Roger said, you go do this, because you said you can do that, you go do that. But by God, you better be able to do it. And when you don't do it, you're gone like that.
I want to ask you to read something from your book. It's a scene where Sidney Pollack has basically punched you in the gut with some news. He says, you are not a leading man.
Right.
He's talking about casting a movie and recasting a role, and you want that role.
This was during the shooting of They Shoot Horses, Don't They?
Yeah.
I'm saying I'm an actor who was blessed with certain kinds of unique abilities, who had a chance to be a truly great actor and hasn't been yet. That was set in 69, and I would say 38 years later that I'm an actor who has never given his best performance. I figure I've got, you know, at least 15 years left of positive role-playing to do where I can be productive and people can still get a kick out of me and watch me and my mind and my character work doing interesting things. I have no desire to retire. I mean, I look at Paul Newman and he says he's stepping back, but he's done it all.
Bruce Dern is an Oscar and Emmy-nominated actor of the stage and the large and small screen. He's currently featured in the HBO series Big Love. His new memoir is Things I've Said But Probably Shouldn't Have, an unrepentant memoir. Bruce, thanks for being on The Business.
Oh, thank you very much. You're a terrific interviewer. You're very well prepared.
I spent much of last week at the Beverly Hilton Hotel attending the Television Critics Summer Press Tour, what's better known as the TCAs. It's the time when the networks spend lavishly on the TV press to win them over and build support for their new season. No one decides what they're going to watch on TV based on what the critics say, but the networks will use the quotes from reviews to promote their pablum to John Q. Public. Ben Bernal of the Phoenix Penny Saver says the Singing Bee is not vomitatious. Wandering around the truck stop of a hotel that is the Beverly Hilton, you will find a tragically unhip mass of laptop-toting, pleated khaki-wearing journalists, and I use the term loosely, milling about and repeatedly saying, "Worst episode ever." In a business where executives are rarely made available to the press, it's a feeding frenzy. But it's also a very unsatisfying meal, because the goal of the network executives is to talk as long as possible without really saying anything. Simultaneously, they're courting as much publicity as possible. Each network holds 2 days of presentations in which they trot out execs, producers, and stars, making them all available for the reporters and critics' arcane and sometimes petulant questions. For instance, as NBC's new entertainment co-chair Ben Silverman sat on stage in the Hilton's International Ballroom last week, the first question seemed to have been lobbed by a guy named Molotov. Quote, "Ben, what would you say about a company that hires somebody for $6 million and fires them after a month? Is that a good company or a bad company?" Silverman's predecessor, Kevin Reilly, had been fired shortly after his contract had been renewed. Another top NBC executive, Mark Graboff, leapt to explain that Reilly technically wasn't fired. Rather, after Silverman was hired, Graboff explained, quote, "Kevin realized or determined that there was no role for him at the company and decided to move on." As Variety's Brian Lowry aptly pointed out, the laughter from the press room betrayed the point for what it was, a distinction without a difference. We all know Kevin Reilly was fired. It's old news. Surely there are better questions to ask the new chairman of a network. Like, for instance, "Aren't you deeply in conflict of interest since your TV production company is still selling and profiting from shows that are in development at the network you now head?" Or it could be a chance to ask bigger, strategic questions like, "How long will television continue to be an ad-supported medium?" Or, "How will you deliver your product to people who don't want to watch it on a given channel, at a given time, or even on a television screen?" But instead, I watched the director Mick G gamely answering questions from an obscure webhead who was demanding to know about McGee's new show, Chuck. The show is about a computer geek who accidentally downloads a whole server of sensitive government secrets into his brain, making him the world's most unlikely secret agent. "What happens," the web guy asked breathlessly, "when Chuck runs out of secrets?" Stay tuned. Chuck airs Monday nights this fall on NBC. And that's The Business. Matt Holzman produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. Our associate producer is Darby Maloney. You can listen to this or any past program online anytime at kcrw.com/thebusiness. You can also podcast the show on KCRW's site or through iTunes. Our email address is thebusiness@kcrw.org. The Business is produced by KCRW Santa Monica and distributed by National Public Radio. I'm Club Professor Ackner. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts covering politics, news, music, arts, and culture. For more details, visit kcrw.com.
Support for NPR comes from Fox Searchlight, presenting Once, the tale of two kindred spirits making music and finding romance on the bustling streets of Dublin, now playing in select theaters.